Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Pearl by John Steinbeck, narrated by Frank Muller.
In the town, they tell the story of the Great Pearl, how it was found and how it was lost again. They tell of Kino, the fisherman, and of his wife, Juana, and of the baby, Coyotito. And because the story has been told so often, it has taken root in every man's mind. And as with all retold tales that are in people's hearts, there are only good and bad things, and black and white things, and good and evil things, and no in-between anywhere. If this story is a parable, perhaps everyone takes his own meaning from it, and reads his own life into it. In any case, they say in the town that 1. Kino awakened in the near dark. The stars still shone, and the day had drawn only a pale wash of light in the lower sky to the east. The roosters had been crowing for some time, and the early pigs were already beginning their ceaseless turning of twigs and bits of wood to see whether anything to eat had been overlooked. Outside the brush house in the tuna clump, a covey of little birds chittered and flurried with their wings. Kino's eyes opened, and he looked first at the lightning square, which was the door, and then he looked at the hanging box where Coyotito slept. And last he turned his head to Juana, his wife, who lay beside him on the mat, her blue head shawl over her nose and over her breasts and around the small of her back. Juana's eyes were open, too. Kino could never remember seeing them closed when he awakened. Her dark eyes made little reflected stars. She was looking at him as she was always looking at him when he awakened. Kino heard the little splash of morning waves on the beach. It was very good. Kino closed his eyes again to listen to his music. Perhaps he alone did this, and perhaps all of his people did it. His people had once been great makers of songs, so that everything they saw or thought or did or heard became a song. That was very long ago. The songs remained, Kino knew them, but no new songs were added. That does not mean that there were no personal songs. In Kino's head there was a song now, clear and soft, and if he had been able to speak of it, he would have called it the Song of the Family. His blanket was over his nose to protect him from the dank air. His eyes flicked to a rustle beside him. It was Juana arising almost soundlessly. On her hard, bare feet, she went to the hanging box where Coyotito slept, and she leaned over and said a little reassuring word. Coyotito looked up for a moment and closed his eyes and slept again. Juana went to the fire pit and uncovered a coal and fanned it alive while she broke little pieces of brush over it. Now Kino got up and wrapped his blanket about his head and nose and shoulders. He slipped his feet into his sandals and went outside to watch the dawn. Outside the door, he squatted down and gathered the blanket ends about his knees. He saw the specks of gulf clouds flame high in the air. And a goat came near and sniffed at him and stared with its cold yellow eyes. Behind him, Juana's fire leaped into flame and threw spears of light through the chinks of the brush house wall and threw a wavering square of light out the door. A late moth blustered in to find the fire. The song of the family came now from behind Kino, and the rhythm of the family song was the grinding stone where Juana worked the corn for the morning cakes. The dawn came quickly now, a wash, a glow, a lightness, and then an explosion of fire as the sun arose out of the gulf. Kino looked down to cover his eyes from the glare. He could hear the pat of the corn cakes in the house and the rich smell of them on the cooking plate. The ants were busy on the ground, big black ones with shiny bodies and little dusty quick ants. Kino watched with the detachment of God while a dusty ant frantically tried to escape the sand trap an ant lion had dug for him. A thin, timid dog came close, and at a soft word from Kino, curled up, arranged its tail neatly over its feet, and laid its chin delicately on the pile. It was a black dog with yellow-gold spots where its eyebrows should have been. It was a morning like other mornings, and yet perfect among mornings. Kino heard the creak of the rope when Juana took Coyotito out of his hanging box and cleaned him and hammocked him in her shawl in a loop that placed him close to her breast. Kino could see these things without looking at them. Juana sang softly an ancient song that had only three notes and yet endless variety of interval. And this was part of the family song, too. It was all part. Sometimes it rose to an aching chord that caught the throat, saying, "This is safety. This is warmth. This is the whole." Across the brush fence were other brush houses, and the smoke came from them too, and the sound of breakfast. But those were other songs. Their pigs were other pigs. Their wives were not Juana. Kino was young and strong, and his black hair hung over his brown forehead. His eyes were warm and fierce and bright, and his mustache was thin and coarse. He lowered his blanket from his nose now, for the dark, poisonous air was gone, and the yellow sunlight fell on the house. Near the brush fence, two roosters bowed and feinted at each other with squared wings and neck feathers roughed out. It would be a clumsy fight. They were not game chickens. Kino watched them for a moment, and then his eyes went up to a flight of wild doves twinkling inland to the hills. The world was awake now, and Kino arose and went into his brush house. As he came through the door, Juana stood up from the glowing fire pit. She put Coyotito back in his hanging box, and then she combed her black hair and braided it in two braids and tied the ends with thin green ribbon. Kino squatted by the fire pit and rolled a hot corn cake and dipped it in sauce and ate it. And he drank a little pulque, and that was breakfast. That was the only breakfast he had ever known outside of feast days, and one incredible fiesta on cookies that had nearly killed him. When Kino had finished, Juana came back to the fire and ate her breakfast. They had spoken once, but there is not need for speech if it is only a habit anyway. Kino sighed with satisfaction, and that was conversation. The sun was warming the brush house, breaking through its crevices in long streaks. And one of the streaks fell on the hanging box where Coyotito lay, and on the ropes that held it. It was a tiny movement that drew their eyes to the hanging box. Kino and Juana froze in their positions. Down the rope that hung the baby's box from the roof support, a scorpion moved slowly. His stinging tail was straight out behind him, but he could whip it up in a flash of time. Kino's breath whistled in his nostrils, and he opened his mouth to stop it. And then the startled look was gone from him and the rigidity from his body. In his mind a new song had come, the song of evil, the music of the enemy, of any foe of the family, a savage, secret, dangerous melody, and underneath the song of the family cried plaintively. The scorpion moved delicately down the rope toward the box. Under her breath, Juana repeated an ancient magic to guard against such evil, and on top of that she muttered a Hail Mary between clenched teeth. But Kino was in motion. His body glided quietly across the room, noiselessly and smoothly. His hands were in front of him, palms down, and his eyes were on the scorpion. Beneath it in the hanging box, Coyotito laughed and reached up his hand toward it. It sensed danger when Kino was almost within reach of it. It stopped and its tail rose up over its back in little jerks, and the curved thorn on the tail's end glistened. Kino stood perfectly still. He could hear Juana whispering the old magic again, and he could hear the evil music of the enemy. He could not move until the scorpion moved, and it felt for the source of the death that was coming to it. Kino's hand went forward very slowly, very smoothly. The thorn tail jerked upright, and at that moment the laughing Coyotito shook the rope and the scorpion fell. Kino's hand leaped to catch it, but it fell past his fingers, fell on the baby's shoulder, landed and struck. Then, snarling, Kino had it in his fingers, rubbing it to a paste in his hands. He threw it down and beat it into the earth floor with his fist, and Coyotito screamed with pain in his box. But Kino beat and stamped the enemy until it was only a fragment and a moist place in the dirt. His teeth were bared, and fury flared in his eyes, and the song of the enemy roared in his ears. But Juana had the baby in her arms now. She found the puncture with redness starting from it already. She put her lips down over the puncture and sucked hard and spat and sucked again while Coyotito screamed. Kino hovered. He was helpless. He was in the way. The screams of the baby brought the neighbors. Out of their brush houses they poured. Kino's brother, Juan Tomas, and his fat wife, Apollonia, and their four children crowded in the door and blocked the entrance, while behind them others tried to look in, and one small boy crawled among legs to have a look. And those in front passed the word back to those behind. "Scorpion, the baby has been stung!" Juana stopped sucking the puncture for a moment. The little hole was slightly enlarged, and its edges whitened from the sucking, but the red swelling extended farther around it in a hard, lymphatic mound. And all of these people knew about the scorpion. An adult might be very ill from the sting, but a baby could easily die from the poison. First, they knew, would come swelling and fever and tightened throat, and then cramps in the stomach, and then Coyotito might die, if enough of the poison had gone in. But the stinging pain of the bite was going away. Coyotito's screams turned to moans. Kino had wondered often at the iron in his patient, fragile wife. She who was obedient and respectful and cheerful and patient, she could arch her back in child pain with hardly a cry. She could stand fatigue and hunger almost better than Kino himself. In the canoe she was like a strong man. And now she did a most surprising thing. "The doctor," she said. "Go to get the doctor." The word was passed out among the neighbors where they stood close-packed in the little yard behind the brush fence. And they repeated among themselves, "Juana wants the doctor." A wonderful thing, a memorable thing, to want the doctor. To get him would be a remarkable thing. The doctor never came to the cluster of brush houses. Why should he, when he had more than he could do to take care of the rich people who lived in the stone and plaster houses of the town? "He would not come," the people in the yard said. "He would not come," the people in the door said, and the thought got into Kino. "The doctor would not come," Kino said to Juana. She looked up at him, her eyes as cold as the eyes of a lioness. This was Juana's first baby. This was nearly everything there was in Juana's world. And Kino saw her determination, and the music of the family sounded in his head with a steely tone. "Then we will go to him," Juana said. And with one hand she arranged her dark blue shawl over her head, and made of one end of it a sling to hold the moaning baby, and made of the other end of it a shade over his eyes to protect him from the light. The people in the door pushed against those behind to let her through. Kino followed her. They went out of the gate to the rutted path, and the neighbors followed them. The thing had become a neighborhood affair. They made a quick, soft-footed procession into the center of the town. First Juana and Kino, and behind them Juan Tomas and Apollonia, her big stomach jiggling with the strenuous pace. Then all the neighbors, with the children trotting on the flanks. and the yellow sun threw their black shadows ahead of them so that they walked on their own shadows. They came to the place where the brush houses stopped and the city of stone and plaster began, the city of harsh outer walls and inner cool gardens, where a little water played and the bougainvillea crusted the walls with purple and brick red and white. They heard from the secret gardens the singing of caged birds and heard the splash of cooling water on hot flagstones. The procession crossed the blinding plaza and passed in front of the church. It had grown now, and on the outskirts the hurrying newcomers were being softly informed how the baby had been stung by a scorpion, how the father and mother were taking it to the doctor. And the newcomers, particularly the beggars from the front of the church, who were great experts in financial analysis, looked quickly at Juana's old blue skirt, saw the tears in her shawl, appraised the green ribbon on her braids, read the age of Kino's blanket and the thousand washings of his clothes, and set them down as poverty people, and went along to see what kind of drama might develop. The four beggars in front of the church knew everything in the town. They were students of the expressions of young women as they went into confession, and they saw them as they came out and read the nature of the sin. They knew every little scandal and some very big crimes. They slept at their posts in the shadow of the church so that no one crept in for consolation without their knowledge. And they knew the doctor. They knew his ignorance, his cruelty, his avarice, his appetites, his sins. They knew his clumsy abortions and the little brown pennies he gave sparingly for alms. They had seen his corpses go into the church. And since early mass was over and business was slow, they followed the procession, these endless searchers after perfect knowledge of their fellow men, to see what the fat, lazy doctor would do about an indigent baby with a scorpion bite. The scurrying procession came at last to the big gate in the wall of the doctor's house. They could hear the splashing water and the singing of caged birds and the sweep of the long brooms on the flagstones. And they could smell the frying of good bacon from the doctor's house. Kino hesitated a moment. This doctor was not of his people. This doctor was of a race which for nearly 400 years had beaten and starved and robbed and despised Kino's race, and frightened it too, so that the indigene came humbly to the door. And as always, when he came near to one of this race, Kino felt weak and afraid and angry at the same time. Rage and terror went together. He could kill the doctor more easily than he could talk to him. For all of the doctor's race spoke to all of Kino's race as though they were simple animals. And as Kino raised his right hand to the iron ring knocker in the gate, rage swelled in him, and the pounding music of the enemy beat in his ears, and his lips grew tight against his teeth. But with his left hand he reached to take off his hat. The iron ring pounded against the gate. Kino took off his hat and stood waiting. Coyotito moaned a little in Juana's arms, and she spoke softly to him. The procession crowded close, the better to see and hear. After a moment, the big gate opened a few inches. Kino could see the green coolness of the garden and little splashing fountain through the opening. The man who looked out at him was one of his own race. Kino spoke to him in the old language. "The little one, the firstborn, has been poisoned by the scorpion," Kino said. "He requires the skill of the healer." The gate closed a little, and the servant refused to speak in the old language. "A little moment," he said. "I go to inform myself." And he closed the gate and slid the bolt home. The glaring sun threw the bunched shadows of the people blackly on the white wall. In his chamber, the doctor sat up in his high bed. He had on his dressing gown of red watered silk that had come from Paris, a little tight over the chest now if it was buttoned. On his lap was a silver tray with a silver chocolate pot and a tiny cup of eggshell china, so delicate that it looked silly when he lifted it with his big hand, lifted it with the tips of thumb and forefinger, and spread the other three fingers wide to get them out of the way. His eyes rested in puffy little hammocks of flesh, and his mouth drooped with discontent. He was growing very stout, and his voice was hoarse with the fat that pressed on his throat. Beside him, on a table, was a small oriental gong and a bowl of cigarettes. The furnishings of the room were heavy and dark and gloomy. The pictures were religious, even the large tinted photograph of his dead wife, who, if masses willed and paid for out of her own estate could do it, was in heaven. The doctor had once, for a short time, been a part of the great world, and his whole subsequent life was memory and longing for France. "That," he said, "was civilized living." By which he meant that on a small income he had been able to keep a mistress and eat in restaurants. He poured his second cup of chocolate and crumbled a sweet biscuit in his fingers. The servant from the gate came to the open door and stood, waiting to be noticed. "Yes?" the doctor asked.
"It is a little Indian with a baby. He says a scorpion stung it."
The doctor put his cup down gently before he let his anger rise.
"Have I nothing better to do than cure insect bites for little Indians? I am a doctor, not a veterinary."
"Yes, patron," said the servant.
"Has he any money?" the doctor demanded. "No, they never have any money. I alone in the world am supposed to work for nothing, and I'm tired of it. See if he has any money."
At the gate the servant opened the door a trifle and looked out at the waiting people. And this time he spoke in the old language.
"Have you money to pay for the treatment?"
Now Kino reached into a secret place somewhere under his blanket. He brought out a paper folded many times. Crease by crease he unfolded it, until at last there came to view 8 small misshapen seed pearls, as ugly and gray as little ulcers, flattened and almost valueless. The servant took the paper and closed the gate again, but this time he was not gone long. He opened the gate just wide enough to pass the paper back.
"The doctor has gone out," he said. "He was called to a serious case."
And he shut the gate quickly out of shame. And now a wave of shame went over the whole procession. They melted away. The beggars went back to the church steps, the stragglers moved off, and the neighbors departed so that the public shaming of Kino would not be in their eyes. For a long time, Kino stood in front of the gate with Juana beside him. Slowly he put his suppliant hat on his head. Then, without warning, he struck the gate a crushing blow with his fist. He looked down in wonder at his split knuckles and at the blood that flowed down between his fingers. 2. The town lay on a broad estuary, its old yellow plastered buildings hugging the beach. And on the beach the white and blue canoes that came from Nayarit were drawn up, canoes preserved for generations by a hard shell-like waterproof plaster whose making was a secret of the fishing people. They were high and graceful canoes, with curving bow and stern and a braced section midships where a mast could be stepped to carry a small lateen sail. The beach was yellow sand, but at the water's edge a rubble of shell and algae took its place. Fiddler crabs bubbled and sputtered in their holes in the sand, and in the shallows little lobsters popped in and out of their tiny homes in the rubble and sand. The sea bottom was rich with crawling and swimming and growing things. The brown algae waved in the gentle currents, and the green eelgrass swayed and little seahorses clung to its stems. Spotted botete, the poison fish, lay on the bottom in the eelgrass beds, and the bright-colored swimming crabs scampered over them. On the beach, the hungry dogs and the hungry pigs of the town searched endlessly for any dead fish or seabird that might have floated in on a rising tide. Although the morning was young, The hazy mirage was up. The uncertain air that magnified some things and blotted out others hung over the whole gulf, so that all sights were unreal and vision could not be trusted, so that sea and land had the sharp clarities and the vagueness of a dream. Thus it might be that the people of the gulf trust things of the spirit and things of the imagination, but they do not trust their eyes to show them distance or clear outline or any optical exactness. Across the estuary from the town, one section of mangrove stood clear and telescopically defined, while another mangrove clump was a hazy black-green blob. Part of the far shore disappeared into a shimmer that looked like water. There was no certainty in seeing, no proof that what you saw was there or was not there. And the people of the gulf expected all places were that way, and it was not strange to them. A copper haze hung over the water, and the hot morning sun beat on it and made it vibrate blindingly. The brush houses of the fishing people were back from the beach on the right-hand side of the town, and the canoes were drawn up in front of this area. Kino and Juana came slowly down to the beach and to Kino's canoe, which was the one thing of value he owned in the world. It was very old. Kino's grandfather had brought it from Nayarit, and he had given it to Kino's father, and so it had come to Kino. It was at once property and source of food, for a man with a boat can guarantee a woman that she will eat something. It is the bulwark against starvation. And every year Kino refinished his canoe with the hard, shell-like plaster by the secret method that had also come to him from his father. Now he came to the canoe and touched the bow tenderly, as he always did. He laid his diving rock and his basket and the two ropes in the sand by the canoe, and he folded his blanket and laid it in the bow. Juana laid Coyotito on the blanket, and she placed her shawl over him so that the hot sun could not shine on him. He was quiet now, but the swelling on his shoulder had continued up his neck and under his ear, and his face was puffed and feverish. Juana went to the water and waded in. She gathered some brown seaweed and made a flat, damp poultice of it, and this she applied to the baby's swollen shoulder, which was as good a remedy as any, and probably better than the doctor could have done. But the remedy lacked his authority, because it was simple and didn't cost anything. The stomach cramps had not come to Coyotito. Perhaps Juana had sucked out the poison in time, but she had not sucked out her worry over her firstborn. She had not prayed directly for the recovery of the baby. She had prayed that they might find a pearl with which to hire the doctor to cure the baby, for the minds of people are as unsubstantial as the mirage of the gulf. Now Kino and Juana slid the canoe down the beach to the water, and when the bow floated, Juana climbed in, while Kino pushed the stern in and waded beside it until it floated lightly and trembled on the little breaking waves. Then, in coordination, Juana and Kino drove their double-bladed paddles into the sea, and the canoe creased the water and hissed with speed. The other pearlers were gone out long since. In a few moments, Kino could see them clustered in the haze riding over the oyster bed. Light filtered down through the water to the bed, where the frilly pearl oysters lay fastened to the rubbly bottom, a bottom strewn with shells of broken, opened oysters. This was the bed that had raised the King of Spain to be a great power in Europe in past years, had helped to pay for his wars, and had decorated the churches for his soul's sake. The gray oysters with ruffles like skirts on the shells, the barnacle-crusted oysters with little bits of weed clinging to the skirts and small crabs climbing over them. An accident could happen to these oysters. A grain of sand could lie in the folds of muscle and irritate the flesh, until, in self-protection, the flesh coated the grain with a layer of smooth cement. But once started, the flesh continued to coat the foreign body until it fell free in some tidal flurry or until the oyster was destroyed. For centuries, men had dived down and torn the oysters from the beds and ripped them open, looking for the coated grains of sand. Swarms of fish lived near the bed to live near the oysters thrown back by the searching men and to nibble at the shining inner shells. But the pearls were accidents, and the finding of one was luck, a little pat on the back by God or the gods or both. Kino had two ropes, one tied to a heavy stone and one to a basket. He stripped off his shirt and trousers and laid his hat in the bottom of the canoe. The water was oily smooth. He took his rock in one hand and his basket in the other, and he slipped feet first over the side, and the rock carried him to the bottom. The bubbles rose behind him until the water cleared and he could see. Above, the surface of the water was an undulating mirror of brightness, and he could see the bottoms of the canoes sticking through it. Kino moved cautiously so that the water would not be obscured with mud or sand. He hooked his foot in the loop on his rock, and his hands worked quickly, tearing the oysters loose, some singly, others in clusters. He laid them in his basket. In some places, the oysters clung to one another so that they came free in lumps. Now, Kino's people had sung of everything that happened or existed. They had made songs to the fishes, to the sea in anger and to the sea in calm, to the light and the dark and the sun and the moon. And the songs were all in Kino and in his people, every song that had ever been made, even the ones forgotten. And as he filled his basket, the song was in Kino. And the beat of the song was his pounding heart as it ate the oxygen from his held breath. And the melody of the song was the gray-green water and the little scuttling animals and the clouds of fish that flitted by and were gone. But in the song, there was a secret little inner song, hardly perceptible, but always there, sweet and secret and clinging, almost hiding in the counter-melody, and this was the song of the pearl that might be. For every shell thrown in the basket might contain a pearl. Chance was against it, but luck and the gods might be for it. And in the canoe above him, Kino knew that Juana was making the magic of prayer, her face set rigid and her muscles hard, to force the luck, to tear the luck out of the god's hands, for she needed the luck for the swollen shoulder of Coyotito. And because the need was great and the desire was great, the little secret melody of the pearl that might be was stronger this morning. Whole phrases of it came clearly and softly into the song of the undersea. Kino, in his pride and youth and strength, could remain down over 2 minutes without strain, so that he worked deliberately, selecting the largest shells. Because they were disturbed, the oyster shells were tightly closed. A little to his right, a hummock of rubbly rocks stuck up, covered with young oysters not ready to take. Kino moved next to the hummock, and then, beside it, under a little overhang, he saw a very large oyster lying by itself, not covered with its clinging brothers. The shell was partly open, for the overhang protected this ancient oyster, and in the lip-like muscle Kino saw a ghostly gleam, and then the shell closed down. His heart beat out a heavy rhythm, and the melody of the maybe pearl shrilled in his ears. Slowly he forced the oyster loose and held it tightly against his breast. He kicked his foot free from the rock loop, and his body rose to the surface, and his black hair gleamed in the sunlight. He reached over the side of the canoe and laid the oyster in the bottom. Then Juana steadied the boat while he climbed in. His eyes were shining with excitement, but in decency he pulled up his rock, and then he pulled up his basket of oysters and lifted them in. Juana sensed his excitement, and she pretended to look away. It is not good to want a thing too much. It sometimes drives the luck away. You must want it just enough, and you must be very tactful with God or the gods. But Juana stopped breathing. Very deliberately, Kino opened his short, strong knife. He looked speculatively at the basket. Perhaps it would be better to open the oyster last. He took a small oyster from the basket, cut the muscle, searched the folds of flesh, and threw it in the water. Then he seemed to see the great oyster for the first time. He squatted in the bottom of the canoe, picked up the shell, and examined it. The flukes were shining black to brown, and only a few small barnacles adhered to the shell. Now Kino was reluctant to open it. What he had seen, he knew, might be a reflection, a piece of flat shell accidentally drifted in, or a complete illusion. In this gulf of uncertain light, there were more illusions than realities. But Juana's eyes were on him, and she could not wait. She put her hand on Coyotito's covered head.
"Open it," she said softly.
Kino deftly slipped his knife into the edge of the shell. Through the knife he could feel the muscle tighten hard. He worked the blade lever-wise, and the closing muscle parted and the shell fell apart. The lip-like flesh writhed up and then subsided. Kino lifted the flesh, and there it lay, the great pearl, perfect as the moon. It captured the light and refined it and gave it back in silver incandescence. It was as large as a seagull's egg. It was the greatest pearl in the world. Juana caught her breath and moaned a little. And to Kino, the secret melody of the maybe pearl broke clear and beautiful, rich and warm and lovely, glowing and gloating and triumphant. In the surface of the great pearl, he could see dream forms. He picked the pearl from the dying flesh and held it in his palm, and he turned it over and saw that its curve was perfect. Juana came near to stare at it in his hand, and it was the hand he had smashed against the doctor's gate, and the torn flesh of the knuckles was turned grayish-white by the seawater. Instinctively, Juana went to Coyotito, where he lay on his father's blanket. She lifted the poultice of seaweed and looked at the shoulder. "Kino!" she cried shrilly. He looked past his pearl, and he saw that the swelling was going out of the baby's shoulder. The poison was receding from its body. Then Kino's fist closed over the pearl, and his emotion broke over him. He put back his head and howled. His eyes rolled up, and he screamed, and his body was rigid. The men in the other canoes looked up, startled, and then they dug their paddles into the sea and raced toward Kino's canoe.
This ends Disc 1, The Pearl, Disc 2.
3. A town is a thing like a colonial animal. A town has a nervous system and a head and shoulders and feet. A town is a thing separate from all other towns, so that there are no two towns alike. And a town has a whole emotion. How news travels through a town is a mystery not easily to be solved. News seems to move faster than small boys can scramble and dart to tell it, faster than women can call it over the fences. Before Kino and Juana and the other fishers had come to Kino's brush house, the nerves of the town were pulsing and vibrating with the news. Kino had found the pearl of the world. Before panting little boys could strangle out the words, their mothers knew it. The news swept on past the brush houses, and it washed in a foaming wave into the town of stone and plaster. It came to the priest walking in his garden, and it put a thoughtful look in his eyes, and a memory of certain repairs necessary to the church. He wondered what the pearl would be worth, and he wondered whether he had baptized Kino's baby, or married him for that matter. The news came to the shopkeepers, and they looked at men's clothes that had not sold so well. The news came to the doctor, where he sat with a woman whose illness was age, though neither she nor the doctor would admit it. And when it was made plain who Kino was, the doctor grew stern and judicious at the same time. "He is a client of mine," the doctor said. "I am treating his child for a scorpion sting." And the doctor's eyes rolled up a little in their fat hammocks, and he thought of Paris. He remembered the room he had lived in there as a great and luxurious place, and he remembered the hard-faced woman who had lived with him as a beautiful and kind girl, although she had been none of these three. The doctor looked past his aged patient and saw himself sitting in a restaurant in Paris, and a waiter was just opening a bottle of wine. The news came early to the beggars in front of the church, and it made them giggle a little with pleasure, for they knew that there is no almsgiver in the world like a poor man who is suddenly lucky. Kino had found the pearl of the world. In the town, in little offices, sat the men who bought pearls from the fishers. They waited in their chairs until the pearls came in, and then they cackled and fought and shouted and threatened until they reached the lowest price the fishermen would stand. But there was a price below which they dared not go, for it had happened that a fisherman in despair had given his pearls to the church. And when the buying was over, these buyers sat alone, and their fingers played restlessly with the pearls, and they wished they owned the pearls. For there were not many buyers, really. There was only one, and he kept these agents in separate offices to give a semblance of competition. The news came to these men, and their eyes squinted and their fingertips burned a little, and each one thought how the patron could not live forever and someone had to take his place. And each one thought how with some capital he could get a new start. All manner of people grew interested in Kino, people with things to sell and people with favors to ask. Kino had found the pearl of the world. The essence of pearl mixed with essence of men, and a curious dark residue was precipitated. Every man suddenly became related to Kino's pearl. And Kino's pearl went into the dreams, the speculations, the schemes, the plans, the futures, the wishes, the needs, the lusts, the hungers of everyone. And only one person stood in the way, and that was Kino, so that he became, curiously, every man's enemy. The news stirred up something infinitely black and evil in the town. The black distillate was like the scorpion, or like hunger in the smell of food, or like loneliness when love is withheld. The poison sacks of the town began to manufacture venom, and the town swelled and puffed with the pressure of it. But Kino and Juana did not know these things. Because they were happy and excited, they thought everyone shared their joy. Juan Tomas and Apollonia did, and they were the world too. In the afternoon, when the sun had gone over the mountains of the peninsula to sink in the outward sea, Kino squatted in his house with Juana beside him. And the brush house was crowded with neighbors. Kino held the great pearl in his hand, and it was warm and alive in his hand. And the music of the pearl had merged with the music of the family, so that one beautified the other. The neighbors looked at the pearl in Kino's hand, and they wondered how such luck could come to any man. And Juan Tomas, who squatted on Kino's right hand because he was his brother, asked, "What will you do now that you have become a rich man?" Kino looked into his pearl, and Juana cast her eyelashes down and arranged her shawl to cover her face so that her excitement could not be seen. And in the incandescence of the pearl, the pictures formed of the things Kino's mind had considered in the past and had given up as impossible. In the pearl he saw Juana and Coyotito and himself standing and kneeling at the high altar, and they were being married now that they could pay. He spoke softly. "We will be married in the church." In the pearl he saw how they were dressed, Juana in a shawl stiff with newness and a new skirt, and from under the long skirt Kino could see that she wore shoes. It was in the pearl, the picture glowing there. He himself was dressed in new white clothes, and he carried a new hat, not of straw but of fine black felt. And he too wore shoes, not sandals, but shoes that laced. But Coyotito, he was the one. He wore a blue sailor suit from the United States and a little yachting cap, such as Kino had seen once when a pleasure boat put into the estuary. All of these things Kino saw in the lucent pearl, and he said, we will have new clothes. And the music of the Pearl rose like a chorus of trumpets in his ears. Then to the lovely gray surface of the Pearl came the little things Kino wanted. A harpoon to take the place of one lost a year ago, a new harpoon of iron with a ring in the end of the shaft, and, his mind could hardly make the leap, a rifle. But why not, since he was so rich? And Kino saw Kino in the Pearl, Kino holding a Winchester carbine. It was the wildest daydreaming and very pleasant. His lips moved hesitantly over this. "A rifle," he said. "Perhaps a rifle." It was the rifle that broke down the barriers. This was an impossibility, and if he could think of having a rifle, whole horizons were burst, and he could rush on. For it is said that humans are never satisfied, that you give them one thing and they want something more. And this is said in disparagement, whereas it is one of the greatest talents the species has, and one that made it superior to animals that are satisfied with what they have. The neighbors, close-pressed and silent in the house, nodded their heads at his wild imaginings, and a man in the rear murmured, "A rifle, he will have a rifle." But the music of the Pearl was shrilling with triumph in Kino. Juana looked up, and her eyes were wide at Kino's courage and at his imagination. And electric strength had come to him, now the horizons were kicked out. In the Pearl he saw Coyotito sitting at a little desk in a school, just as Kino had once seen it through an open door. And Coyotito was dressed in a jacket, and he had on a white collar and a broad silken tie. Moreover, Coyotito was writing on a big piece of paper. Kino looked at his neighbors fiercely. "My son will go to school," he said, and the neighbors were hushed. Juana caught her breath sharply. Her eyes were bright as she watched him, and she looked quickly down at Coyotito in her arms to see whether this might be possible. But Kino's face shone with prophecy. "My son will read and open the books, and my son will write and will know writing, and my son will make numbers, and these things will make us free, because he will know, and through him we will know." And in the Pearl, Kino saw himself and Juana squatting by the little fire in the brush hut while Coyotito read from a great book. "This is what the Pearl will do," said Kino. And he had never said so many words together in his life. And suddenly he was afraid of his talking. His hand closed down over the Pearl and cut the light away from it. Kino was afraid, as a man is afraid who says, "I will," without knowing. Now the neighbors knew they had witnessed a great marvel. They knew that time would now date from Kino's Pearl, and that they would discuss this moment for many years to come. If these things came to pass, they would recount how Kino looked and what he said, and how his eyes shone, and they would say he was a man transfigured. Some power was given to him, and there it started. You see what a great man he has become, starting from that moment, and I myself saw it. And if Kino's planning came to nothing, those same neighbors would say there it started. A foolish madness came over him, so that he spoke foolish words. God keep us from such things. Yes, God punished Kino, because he rebelled against the way things are. You see what has become of him, and I myself saw the moment when his reason left him. Kino looked down at his closed hand, and the knuckles were scabbed over and tight where he had struck the gate. Now the dusk was coming, and Juana looped her shawl under the baby so that he hung against her hip, and she went to the fire hole and dug a coal from the ashes and broke a few twigs over it and fanned a flame alive. The little flames danced on the faces of the neighbors. They knew they should go to their own dinners, but they were reluctant to leave. The dark was almost in, and Juana's fire threw shadows on the brush walls when the whisper came in, passed from mouth to mouth, "The father is coming, the priest is coming." The men uncovered their heads and stepped back from the door, and the women gathered their shawls about their faces and cast down their eyes. Kino and Juan Tomas, his brother, stood up. The priest came in, a graying, aging man with an old skin and a young, sharp eye. Children, he considered these people, and he treated them like children. Kino, he said softly, thou art named after a great man and a great father of the church. He made it sound like a benediction. Thy namesake tamed the desert and sweetened the minds of thy people. Didst thou know that? It is in the books. Kino looked quickly down at Coyotito's head, where he hung on Juana's hip. Some day, his mind said, that boy would know what things were in the books and what things were not. The music had gone out of Kino's head, but now, thinly, slowly, the melody of the morning, the music of evil, of the enemy, sounded. But it was faint and weak. And Kino looked at his neighbors to see who might have brought this song in. But the priest was speaking again. It has come to me that thou hast found a great fortune, a great pearl. Kino opened his hand and held it out, and the priest gasped a little at the size and beauty of the pearl. And then he said, I hope thou wilt remember to give thanks, my son, to him who has given thee this treasure, and to pray for guidance in the future. Kino nodded dumbly, and it was Juana who spoke softly. We will, father, and we will be married now. Kino has said so. She looked at the neighbors for confirmation, and they nodded their heads solemnly. The priest said, It is pleasant to see that your first thoughts are good thoughts. God bless you, my children. He turned and left quietly, and the people let him through. But Kino's hand had closed tightly on the pearl again, and he was glancing about suspiciously, for the evil song was in his ears, shrilling against the music of the pearl. The neighbors slipped away to go to their houses, and Juana squatted by the fire and set her clay pot of boiled beans over the little flame. Kino stepped to the doorway and looked out. As always, he could smell the smoke from many fires, and he could see the hazy stars and feel the damp of the night air, so that he covered his nose from it. The thin dog came to him and threshed itself in greeting like a wind-blown flag, and Kino looked down at it and didn't see it. He had broken through the horizons into a cold and lonely outside. He felt alone and unprotected, and scraping crickets and shrilling tree frogs and croaking toads seemed to be carrying the melody of evil. Kino shivered a little and drew his blanket more tightly against his nose. He carried the pearl still in his hand, tightly closed in his palm, and it was warm and smooth against his skin. Behind him he heard Juana patting the cakes before she put them down on the clay cooking sheet. Kino felt all the warmth and security of his family behind him, and the song of the family came from behind him like the purring of a kitten. But now, by saying what his future was going to be like, he had created it. A plan is a real thing, and things projected are experienced. A plan once made and visualized becomes a reality, along with other realities, never to be destroyed, but easily to be attacked. Thus, Kino's future was real, but having set it up, other forces were set up to destroy it, and this he knew, so that he had to prepare to meet the attack. And this Kino knew also, that the gods do not love men's plans, and the gods do not love success unless it comes by accident. He knew that the gods take their revenge on a man if he be successful through his own efforts. Consequently, Kino was afraid of plans, but having made one, he could never destroy it. And to meet the attack, Kino was already making a hard skin for himself against the world. His eyes and his mind probed for danger before it appeared. Standing in the door, he saw two men approach, and one of them carried a lantern which lighted the ground and the legs of the men. They turned in through the opening of Kino's brush fence and came to his door. And Kino saw that one was the doctor, and the other the servant who had opened the gate in the morning. The split knuckles on Kino's right hand burned when he saw who they were. The doctor said, "I was not in when you came this morning, but now, at the first chance, I have come to see the baby." Kino stood in the door, filling it, and hatred raged and flamed in back of his eyes, and fear, too, for the hundreds of years of subjugation were cut deep in him. "The baby is nearly well now," he said curtly. The doctor smiled, but his eyes in their little lymph-lined hammocks did not smile. He said, "Sometimes, my friend, the scorpion sting has a curious effect. There will be apparent improvement, and then, without warning, poof!" He pursed his lips and made a little explosion to show how quick it could be, and he shifted his small black doctor's bag about so that the light of the lamp fell upon it, for he knew that Kino's race love the tools of any craft and trust them. "Sometimes," the doctor went on in a liquid tone, "sometimes there will be a withered leg, or a blind eye, or a crumpled back. Oh, I know the sting of the scorpion, my friend, and I can cure it." Kino felt the rage and hatred melting toward fear. He did not know, and perhaps this doctor did, and he could not take the chance of pitting his certain ignorance against this man's possible knowledge. He was trapped as his people were always trapped, and would be until, as he had said, they could be sure that the things in the books were really in the books. He could not take a chance, not with the life or with the straightness of Coyotito. He stood aside and let the doctor and his man enter the brush hut. Juana stood up from the fire and backed away as he entered, and she covered the baby's face with the fringe of her shawl. And when the doctor went to her and held out his hand, she clutched the baby tight and looked at Kino where he stood with the fire shadows leaping on his face. Kino nodded, and only then did she let the doctor take the baby. "Hold the light," the doctor said. And when the servant held the lantern high, the doctor looked for a moment at the wound on the baby's shoulder. He was thoughtful for a moment, and then he rolled back the baby's eyelid and looked at the eyeball. He nodded his head while Coyotito struggled against him. "It is as I thought," he said. "The poison has gone inward, and it will strike soon. Come look." He held the eyelid down. "See, it is blue." And Kino, looking anxiously, saw that indeed it was a little blue. And he didn't know whether or not it was always a little blue, but the trap was set. He couldn't take the chance. The doctor's eyes watered in their little hammocks. "I will give him something to try to turn the poison aside," he said. And he handed the baby to Kino. Then from his bag he took a little bottle of white powder and a capsule of gelatin. He filled the capsule with the powder and closed it, and then around the first capsule he fitted a second capsule and closed it. Then he worked very deftly. He took the baby and pinched its lower lip until it opened its mouth. His fat fingers placed the capsule far back on the baby's tongue, back of the point where he could spit it out. And then from the floor he picked up the little pitcher of pulque and gave Coyotito a drink. And it was done. He looked again at the baby's eyeball, and he pursed his lips and seemed to think. At last he handed the baby back to Juana, and he turned to Kino. "I think the poison will attack within the hour," he said. "The medicine may save the baby from hurt, but I will come back in an hour. Perhaps I am in time to save him." He took a deep breath and went out of the hut, and his servant followed him with the lantern. Now Juana had the baby under her shawl, and she stared at it with anxiety and fear. Kino came to her, and he lifted the shawl and stared at the baby. He moved his hand to look under the eyelid, and only then saw that the pearl was still in his hand. Then he went to a box by the wall, and from it he brought a piece of rag. He wrapped the pearl in the rag, then went to the corner of the brush house and dug a little hole with his fingers in the dirt floor, and he put the pearl in the hole and covered it up and concealed the place.